Welcome back to the Sports Talks Podcast. I'm Dr. Ashley Bassett.
And I'm Dr. Catherine Logan.
On each episode, we chat about the most recent developments in sports medicine with experts from around the country. In this episode, we're going to continue our discussion with Dr. Bonnie Chen and focus on surgical treatment for Achilles tendon ruptures.
Our conversation picks back up with an article from the March 2023 issue of AJSM titled, Outcomes and Complications of Open versus Minimally Invasive Repair of Acute Achilles Tendon Ruptures. This level one meta-analysis included 10 randomized controlled trials and found no difference in AOFAS scores and rate of total complications, re-ruptures, deep infections, skin necrosis, wound dehiscence, adhesions, or keloid scars. It's a long list. But there were some significant differences between the groups. Open repair was associated with significantly longer surgical time, higher risk of superficial infections, as well as a higher risk of ankle stiffness. Minimally invasive repair was associated with a higher rate of sural nerve injury, 3.4% compared to 0% in the open procedure group.
Next up is a level one RCT from the June 2020 issue of AJSM titled Comparison of Tendon Lengthening with Traditional versus Accelerated Rehabilitation After Achilles Tendon Repair. Patients were randomized to either a traditional rehab group with weight bearing at 6 weeks or an accelerated rehab group with graduated weight bearing starting at 2 weeks. All patients were found to have tendon lengthening after surgery with no significant differences found in overall lengthening between traditional and accelerated rehab groups. There were also no differences noted in ankle range of motion or outcome scores between the groups.
We finish up with an article from the October 2017 issue of AJSM. It's titled, Professional Athletes Return to Play and Performance After Operative Repair of an Achilles Tendon Rupture. It's a level three cohort study looking at return to play rates and performance among professional athletes after Achilles tendon rupture in the NFL, NBA, MLB, and NHL. The authors found that 30% of the athletes with an isolated Achilles rupture were unable to return to play after surgical repair. Those that were able to return to play had significantly less playing time, less games played, and played significantly worse compared to their preoperative performance levels. The NBA players were the most affected.
If you're looking for a trusted name in osteochondral allograft transplantation, look no further than JRF Ortho. With a stellar track record and a reputation as the leader in fresh osteochondral allografts, JRF Ortho is here to elevate your practice to new heights.
JRF Ortho has proudly distributed over 25,000 allografts worldwide, making a significant impact in the field. Their passion for this industry goes beyond the numbers. It's about helping patients and fulfilling their mission of improving people's quality of life.
But that's not all. At JRF Ortho, they understand that superior customer care is crucial. They aim to give you one less thing to think about so you can focus on what matters the most, your patients.
And they make ordering JRF Ortho easy. They are committed to accommodating your needs and delivering allografts on your terms.
You're in control. Choose your scheduling option, whether it's specifying a surgical date, providing a date range, or just requesting the earliest available allograft. Your preferences are their top priority.
So, prepare for success. Order with JRF Ortho and take control of your orthopedic journey.
Awesome. So welcome back to the show, Bonnie. Now we're going to shift our conversation to the fun stuff. We're going to talk about surgery, your approach to all of that. So our next paper is a meta-analysis that compared open surgical repair to minimally invasive surgical repair. And before we get to the results of that study, we want to talk a bit more about those two options. So for our listeners, can you describe what a minimally invasive repair entails and then how that differs from the traditional open repair in terms of approach, repair construct, implants, kind of all that stuff?
Yeah, so for the traditional open repair, it really is centered over where the rupture site is, and you, incise with the peritoneum, you find the tendon rupture site, clear out the hematoma, you really see the rupture site really directly, and you expose the proximal and the distal ends of the tendons. And there's various different suture constructs that you can use. Typically, people use a non-absorbable suture that's stout enough to have a good grasp on the tendon, and you pass like whipping or locking stitches through the tendon up and down on either end, and you visualize that the whole way, so you kind of see exactly where you put your sutures, how many passes, And then you tie them together in maximal plantar flexion, in my view. Mm-hmm. I don't think you can really over tighten these. Again, like we talked about earlier, they tend to stretch out. Some people, just going off a little bit on another end of thought, some people will prep out both ankles so that when they tension their repair, they'll compare that they matched the tension of the contralateral side. Certainly, I think that's very thoughtful. That's it makes sense. At the same time, I think it's, for me, it's like an extra step. It's an extra leg that's prepped in, potentially extra like source of infection. And again, I think the tendon, it stretches out even with the tightest repair. And so I just maximally tension it, like plantar flex it maximally. So that's in a nutshell, the open repair. For the more minimally invasive techniques, there have been more technology options of various different devices that, like whether it's as simple as like a ringed forceps or a jig that you can insert, in between the peritoneum and the tendon. Then you can make passes with special needle devices that take suture material across the tendon, and then some of them have like a locking feature built in, so you have a better, more robust grasp of the tendon. You don't really have to expose the area where you're passing the sutures, so in contrast to the open repair, you still ideally see the rupture site, so you can slide your device up, but then the incision is much more minimized compared to an open incision. And similarly, you tie the ends together, maximal plantar flexion, and again, the incision, once it comes together, is significantly smaller than an open repair.
And then when you're, Bonnie, when you're choosing like which repair to do, are you doing like what percentage do you sort of fall in the open versus like minimally invasive, and how do you decide?
Percentage wise is hard, a little hardest for me to say. Yeah. Maybe like 80-20, like 80 minimally invasive, 20 open. And I never advertise to the patient that, oh, like my incision is going to be like this small and it's going to be minimally invasive. Like I never tell them that. I say like, a lot of them ask me because I think with media, they recognize some of the brand names of what athletes have gotten. And so they'll ask me and I say, well, like that is an option, but my goal is to get your tendon fixed as well as possible. And we sometimes don't know until we're in there if I think it's going to work. And some of my patients who have Achilles tendon ruptures, I try to do a more minimally invasive approach. If it's relatively acute and it's a mid-substance rupture. But if I find that with the passes of the device, with the needle and the suture, I just don't have a very good grasp of the tendon. And sometimes the tendons are very thin, like more proximally. And even in big, typically younger male patients, like when I would think, oh, like you should have a really robust, thick tendon where they rupture, and probably why they rupture is because their tendon substance wasn't that great. Like, and that particular area is more thin or is closer to the musculotendinous junction, and passing any sort of suture through the muscle is just not going to really work. And so when it's done more blindly with the minimally invasive system, I think there's a risk that you just don't have a good grasp of tendon. It's going to pull out. It's not going to actually achieve the purpose of the surgery, in which case I then extend my incision a bit.
Okay.
So I can get a better grasp of the tendon.
Can I ask a clarifying question about that? When you say extend the incision, so when I've seen, so I do primarily open, not the percutaneous, although I'm interested in shifting more towards that. We just have a foot ankle surgeon, so he does most of those. So usually it's, correct me if I'm wrong, is it a transverse incision for the minimally invasive? And then when you do open, you do longitudinal, or do you do a mini longitudinal incision so that you can extend if you need to?
The latter.
The latter. Okay. Yeah. You're always
the latter. I was like, there's three options. The latter.
Sorry.
I'm not a fan of, I know some of the technique guides teach it that way. Like you can make a transverse incision because then you can kind of go around the tendon. But I always find, my training has always been longitudinal. If you have to extend it, God forbid there's a revision setting, I didn't box myself out with a transverse incision. So I always do, I start with the mini longitudinal, and then if I have to extend it, then I make it bigger on either end.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think it's almost like, I know you're not doing ACLs, but like when there's some people where we do a quad graft, they'll do like
a, thinking that,
a horizontal incision. And I've always done like a small longitudinal or vertical incision, just in case you do need to extend, or, you know, down the line they get a total knee or, you know, whatever. It just seems like odd. They have this like horizontal sort of incision there. But I think, you know, there's plenty of people that do that horizontal. It just doesn't seem right to me.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. And if you put it, I don't know how you feel about this, Bonnie, but if you put it slightly at the wrong level, then you're like boxed into, at least for quad. Like the first couple I did, I was like, man, I wish I was a little lower by the patella so I could release. And I wasn't able to do that. So yeah, I totally agree.
All right. This is a dumb question for someone who is not doing Achilles at this point. How do you, like, Bonnie, you talked about, like, you're trying to figure out, do you have a good like grasp on it? Is it a good size? Like, is that just like a feel, like feedback thing? Or you feel like, how do you know, like, you're going to be happy?
One is I always try to do the minimally invasive jig if I think they are a potential candidate for it. And then, so I work with residents and, I'll let them pass it through. And then sometimes it pulls out and I'm like, okay, well, maybe we weren't in the right spot, so I'll do it. And if it doesn't work for me, then I'm like, oh, maybe it's not really a great time. Then usually when I extend the incision, I just look at the tendon and also a little bit of tactile feedback, but mainly just looking at it. It's like, wow, like this tendon is really thin, or it's like really wimpy, or it's kind of mop ends. And like just passing like 3 sutures through that, to me, just doesn't seem like it's going to get a good grasp and have a good strong repair. And I really then think that doing a more traditional open approach where I see the tendon, I can see where I'm making the suture passes. It's actually going through the tendon and not the muscle. To me, like, makes a lot more sense. And usually with the open approach, I think you make more passes with the suture. There's more locking stitches within it that just minimizes the pullout.
For sure.
So now this meta-analysis that we talked about, so that compared open repair to minimally invasive, found that they performed pretty equivalently across most metrics. So they found the re-rupture rate was really low in both groups and not significantly different between the two groups. Patient-reported outcome scores, overall complication rate was equivalent. But when you looked at the specific complications, they were different. So minimally invasive had a higher rate of sural nerve injury, though it was transient. And then open repair had a higher rate of superficial infection. So what do you take away from this? Do you feel like this mirrors what you're seeing in terms of the risks of both of those procedures? Are you concerned about sural nerve injury risk doing the minimally invasive?
Yeah, I think that's definitely a concern because it's blind and you're sticking like a sharp thing through the transversely perpendicular to the nerve. I think there have also been more developments in the devices, and there's different devices that have been published on. And I think there's some devices that I find minimize the risk of sural nerve injury more, just the way the device is designed. And when the needle passes, it sort of deflects a little bit more instead of kind of directly jabbing into the nerve. I think getting into the right layer is important with your jig, you kind of get in between the peritoneum and the tendon layer. So I think that's one. I think it's pretty rare and usually transient. I would say I agree with that. And I think that's been demonstrated in bigger patient sample sizes as well. And certainly, yes, I think the trade-off of a smaller incision is worthwhile, just because that area of the body doesn't tend to heal as well. And there's frictional forces, there's watershed, vascular supply. It's very superficial, like right underneath your subcutaneous skin is the tendon. So I do think that minimizing incision helps with reducing the risk of infection, and definitely either way, open or minimally invasive. The soft tissue closure is very important. I think trying to preserve the peritoneum, layered closure, protecting the wound with a splint, sufficient time before rehab. What I found, and I don't think this has been reported, but just in my personal experience, like with the minimally invasive devices, particularly when you have to insert them more proximally to try to capture the proximal tendon stump, it does go up a bit of a ways. And I think there's definitely some disruption or irritation of the musculotendinous junction, even just the gastroxoleus like complex in general there. So many times my patients will tell me like it was actually really painful, not necessarily at the incision site, but like in my calf, because I think I just jammed this thing up to, and sometimes you have to do it multiple times. And I do think that that can be irritating. It's again transient, but I think just something that patients wonder, like, oh, but my incision's down here, but I feel like a lot of discomfort and cramping in my calf.
So to summarize, like you know, you kind of brought up a couple really great points as far as like, okay, how do you reduce the risk of sternal nerve injury? And you talked about there's certain devices that do a better job, you feel, you know, sort of getting you on the right path. You talked about getting in the right layer, you know, and obviously like having some more experience with that technique. And then you also started to talk about infection, reducing that risk with like, how do you, you know, doing a layered closure and, you know, being very careful with your closure in general. But what about like antibiotics? Do you do no tourniquet? Like all these, what are all the other things that you do to reduce your infection risk?
It actually reminded me of something. So for my incision, I actually tend to cheat it a little bit more medially. So I don't go directly posterior midline. Because I find that one, the sternal nerve is usually a little bit more lateral. I mean, especially more distal. And so I cheat it a little bit more medially, but also that way I feel that if it's close to where it could experience like more friction in the back of the heel, it's not kind of like right directly in the back. It's a little bit offset. So that's how I personally do it. Other mitigating factors for infection, like definitely, I mean, standard antibiotics, like periop, like with any surgery. I don't send people home with antibiotics post-op. I don't think there's data for that. Tourniquet I do use. I don't think there's specific evidence for Achilles tendon rupture repair about whether tourniquet can increase your risk of infection or not. I think there are studies on like multiple foot and ankle surgeries that suggest potentially it can increase the risk of infection if you use a tourniquet, especially longer. But I think for specifically for Achilles tendon rupture repairs, I don't think there's clear evidence one way or the other. And for me, I think it's helpful because I can see the layers better with the tourniquet. Like I can try to tease out where the peritoneum is, which already is hard to see. Another tip that like I was taught and I implement sometimes, particularly with patients with potentially more thick, robust Achilles tendons, is if I find that, especially with the tendon ends and I'm bringing them together and now they're overlapping and there's like a big chunk of tendon now and it's protruding out of the wound. One thing that can be done is you release the deep fascia like over the FHL. And then you can, it kind of lets the tendon, instead of like bulging out like this, like sit down a little bit.
So when you are passing the suture, sometimes it rips out. You go to go pass it again, it rips out. Quality's maybe not that great. So what happens if you're doing an open repair? You go to go suture that tendon together and it's really crappy. Do you ever augment it with anything, whether it be like local tendon or any of the like commercially available like patches or things like that to add to the healing response?
I haven't added like patches per se. There are some implants out there, I guess they're called implants, that purport that they help with the tendon healing and maybe like reduce some scar adhesions. And I think there's some data for it. I don't think there's like very strong comparative data, but I think it's certainly an option. And if I'm really thinking about augmenting because I'm worried about the repair, I think there's like a kind of a ladder that I think one can consider. I mean, that's like a whole another like topic, and it can get into more of revision type settings for these surgeries or even more chronic injuries. So for me, if it seems like it's a problem of like a gap and like the tendon can't reach, which typically doesn't really happen in an acute setting. If it's a little bit more subacute or chronic, that can happen. If it's like within about 2 to 3 centimeters, I think there's discussion about this. Some people do what's called like a VY lengthening. So it's like it's a big incision because you have to go up higher and you got to measure like your gap, and then you got to account for, you got to take more from your VY to bridge the gap. So that's an option. There's what's called a turndown, which is kind of taking the middle third segment of the tendon also more proximally. And again, you have to account for the gap. You got to add an extra like centimeter or two to where you take the middle. It's almost like the BTB. Yeah. Like you take the middle part of the tendon and then you kind of like invert it like a, I don't know if people understand this, like a French braid, like you invert like a ponytail, and then for it to reach. Because again, you have to account for the length and you have to take extra, the incision is a lot bigger. Otherwise, I think more people are doing probably like autograft and allograft. And certainly for an older patient, but even there's some studies out there showing for younger patients, augmenting with the FHL tendon, I think is probably the most, been most studied and most published. And I think people do really quite well from it. The tendon's right next door. It's right there. It's in line. It's in phase. Minimal morbidity, even though you do lose your FHL function, but a lot of the studies show it doesn't really affect push off that much. I mean, I would think twice if you're taking it from like a dancer, like some like a football player, like somebody who needs that push off. But otherwise, I think it's a viable option. Otherwise, an allograft to bridge gaps. That's another option as well.
Yeah, I think that all makes sense. And, you know, I'm eager to also hear about, you know, your rehab protocols. Like we talked a little bit more about the non-surgical, but with the surgical, you know, that next paper that we have, it talks about two different rehab post-op, where one is traditional, like non-weight bearing 6 weeks, and then accelerated with the weight bearing as tolerated. So if I remember for the non-surgical, you said toe touch is what you do. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of like in between, but you know, where do you fall for your post-op? How do you decide?
After surgery?
Yes, yes.
So I typically have the patients splinted in plantar flexion, like maximally for the first 2 weeks for soft tissue rest, wound protection. I put all my patients on DVT prophylaxis, is I think there's evidence that there's a high risk of DVT in Achilles tendon ruptures. And then now they're had surgery, they're immobilized. So I do that as a precaution. And then at 2 weeks, I take everything off. I check their wound. If the stitches are ready to come out, take them out. And based on the assessment of their wound healing, really, and I check, usually the maximal plantar flexion tension is really great. They don't typically have restoration of the Thompson test yet because there's calf atrophy that like, yeah. And so, that's not really my gauge. It's more, okay, like I can feel the tendon, it's there. The maximal plantar flexion is there. The wound's healed pretty well. Then I progress them in the rehab. And I still start with toe touch because, again, I want to keep them in that plantar flex position for a sufficient period of time. So that's my preference. I don't think starting like weight bearing as tolerated is, I think that's very reasonable too. And I think patients tend to self-protect in a way too. And I think I would also clarify, like when they say weight bearing as tolerated, it's usually like with the boot. So they're kind of really toe touch weight bearing as tolerated. Yeah.
Got it. When do you allow them to weight bear fully? Is it that 6 weeks that you had talked about with the non-surgical?
Yeah, about 6 to 8 weeks. Yeah.
Okay. Got it.
Mm-hmm.
And then I know Ashley, she's a big NFL fan, so she's going to ask you about Aaron Rodgers.
I'll try not to roll my eyeballs.
I don't know anything about football.
Hopefully he doesn't listen to our podcast. I'm sure he does. But every patient that came into my clinic, when he walked on that field, like 10 days after his surgery, wearing no boot with like those walking crutches, was like, how can he do that? So Bonnie, what are your thoughts on that? Do you think it had to do with the surgery that he had? Like, do you think it had to do with like the minimally invasive or the speed bridge? Or do you think he's just Aaron Rodgers being Aaron Rodgers and doing what he wants to do? What are your thoughts? The listeners are dying to know your thoughts. Well,
I don't know Aaron Rodgers' personality enough to comment on this choice, but I mean, I think like these pro athletes are like a different, like, I mean, motivation, incentive, pressure, like to get back ASAP. Yeah. And they get like the most rehab like you could ever get, right? To expedite as much as possible. That, and I always tell my patients, like, you can't compare yourself to them. Like, it's just like, that's their job. Like, that's their professional job. Like, you know, you have another job. Like, your job is not just to heal your tendon. Yeah. And then, but yes, his construct is a bit different. We haven't really talked about this as much, but there's another system. You can do some of it minimally invasively, yes, like the same kind of expose at the tendon rupture site, find the tendon ends, capture the tendon however you want, like open minimally invasively with the sutures, you have a good grasp on it, and then you can do this part percutaneously where there are bone tunnels that are drilled in the posterior calcaneus, and then you take the suture ends proximally and you bring it down. And then you dock it into your bone tunnels. So that's what he had done. And that's certainly an option. I don't do that personally for every one of my patients. I think it, not everybody needs it. I think there can be side effects from having a tunnel in your bone. I think people tend to feel it, even if they don't necessarily feel the implant prominence. Because the materials typically are flush or deep within the bone, and they will actually kind of absorb and integrate into your bone. It takes a long time, but it'll happen over a year or so. But I think just having that there, people feel it. People actually feel it. So I don't do it as first line for all my patients.
It sounds almost like, Catherine, does it sound to you like it's an internal brace, effectively, right? It also is the repair.
Yeah, it's just like trying to give you that little backup so you can be more accelerated is, I think, the thought process. But and that, you know, transitions nicely into the final part we want to cover, which is like, you know, getting back to things and returning to play or returning to activities. And that last paper, it was done at your institution in 2017, looking at return play rates and performance of professional athletes after Achilles tendon repair. And they found that 30% of athletes were unable to return to play after repair. So a pretty big number, like can't get back. And obviously those are the people, like, as you just reflected on, they have people like surrounding them, making sure that, you know, they get all the rehab, the recovery modalities, like all the things. So you know, what do you take away from that? Like, is it just like a push-off performance thing? Do they just like lose a step no matter what? Or, you know, why do you think that number is so high?
Well, I think the demands of the sport can really be challenging, like after an Achilles tendon rupture. And I would say it can depend on the sport. I think as this paper showed, like the getting back to basketball is probably a lot harder than say something where your foot is more flat, like, or more in constant contact with the ground. And we talked about how the tendon stretches out even after the repair. It's a long recovery, even if you have surgery, just for the strength to be sufficient. I think one of the hardest things I tell my patients that I tell them is a goal, but that it's a challenge as well, is your single leg. Yeah, like heel rise, but also like jumping, like single leg hops. Like it's very, very hard. Sometimes people get it back at 6 months, but a lot of times it takes a full year and it's still not quite the same.
Right.
And so when that's like an isolated task that's already very difficult, and then you compound on that like the demands of like all out MBA stuff, like I think it can be challenging.
So Bonnie, how do you determine, because we talked about like clearing people, you said sometimes it could be 6 months, sometimes it could take a year to get that back. How do you determine that an athlete is safe to go into play? Is it a combination of time? Do you do like a return to play assessment? Do you look at their strength? Like, how do you determine they're safe?
I don't personally do the return to play assessment. I think that's a decision that's made, as you guys know, and know probably better than I do, like with the coach, with the trainers, with a lot of different parties that are invested in an athlete. Like I'm not really the one to tell them like, okay, like you can't go back to play now, like, or you can now. Like I give my professional medical advice of like, this really takes this much time. And, but sometimes it's not fully up to me when the athlete's going to go back, because they may have contracts, they may have other pressures and obligations. But I usually tell them that, for instance, like the single heel rise or the single leg hop, if you can do this, then I think you're going to feel more ready to go back to playing. Or like, it's always gradual. It's like, I can't tell you every specific metric that you have to meet, but it's kind of like crawling to walking, to jogging, to running, to sprinting, to hurdling, like progression. And if you can do it, and it's not going to happen like overnight, it's going to be weeks, months, where you're kind of staying at the same level and then you progress. If you can do that, then I think that's a good sign that you're ready to like RTP.
Yeah. Yeah, I think we talk about that a lot, that, you know, there's a lot that goes into any, you know, return to play decision, and it's, you know, multidisciplinary and coaches and the agents and the physical therapist and the sports psychologist, and there's a lot going on. So,
Absolutely.
So we always end our episodes, Bonnie, with like a quick fast five. We're going to ask you five quick questions that we ask every surgeon that are sort of more generic to surgery itself. The first thing, do you do some arthroscopy, right? Ankle arthroscopy?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Do you do foot pedal or hand control?
I do foot pedal. I want to use both of my hands. Everybody tells us you're a two-handed surgeon. I need both of my hands.
So today the hand wasn't working for some reason on the vapor. So I used the foot pedal and I was like, this is lovely. I've been using hands since I got into practice.
Also, like, my hand is really small. Like,
yeah,
I'm like a six. If I had 5.5, it'd be 5.5. But they don't have 5.5. Wow. So then, for me to like kind of like get around the buttons, like
agree. I'm always foot too.
Yes.
Yeah.
All right. So Bonnie, shoes in the OR. What you wearing?
Shoes in the OR? Oh, yeah. Shoes. You said shoes.
Yes.
Yeah. Shoes. Oh, I was saying shoes. I wear UFOs. OOFOS. Have you heard that one?
Yeah. I've seen them.
A sloth is plushy. I won't sprain my ankle.
Nice.
Breathable.
What is your favorite OR lounge snack?
Oh man, we just started a lounge. I mean, I a coffee. Is that a snack? Yeah. Does that count?
That counts for me.
Yeah.
And then what music do you play in the OR?
Oh, hip hop.
Yeah.
Or house EDM.
Last question in the fast five. What is your favorite surgery to do?
Oh man. I have somebody I like. I don't think I have a favorite one, to be honest.
That's okay.
There's so many that I like. Because I kind of do everything. I do the sports, like, I guess I could say in general, I like doing surgeries where I may not have done it in training and I practiced it. And I think, and the reason I try to adopt this is because I think it's going to be better for my patients. Yeah.
It's been so awesome to have you, Bonnie. Like, it's really exciting to see all the things that you're doing, and so much has evolved even since residency, for sure.
Yeah. Yeah, thank you so much for having us.
Absolutely.
This is really great and educational. Thank you for listening to this episode of The Sports Docs. We hope you enjoyed the discussion as much as we did. Make sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, and now on YouTube to stay up to date on all things sports medicine. If you like what you hear, please consider leaving us a review or comment. You can also reach us by email at thesportsdocspod@gmail.com or find us on Instagram at thesportsdocspod and Twitter at thesportsdocpod. We love your feedback.